When I was a little girl, Disneyland in Anaheim, California advertised itself as the happiest place on earth. So dying children, their wish was to go to Disneyland before they were gone. Now I'm grown, children can enjoy happy meals at the local McDonald's, which is a place in many localities at this point. And adults sometimes flock to bars that offer happy hours on weeknights. So there's a kind of ordinary sense of happiness here. Now, the kind of happiness on offer in these venues isn't usually the sort that's under discussion when undergraduates sort of set out to find satisfying careers, a sense of communities, ways of working toward a life that seems both to suit them as individuals with unique tastes, talents, and convictions, and to count as meaningful. The sort of happiness on offer in courses on designing a good life or the strategies developed by positive psychologists to improve one's state of mind and foster resilience in the life are not the sort of thing that the very young were seeking at Disneyland and hoping to get a taste of when they open the Happy Meal box. I suppose that some adults who take advantage of happy hours in order to share drinks with friends or coworkers may be engaging in an activity that combines some of the pleasures associated with the Magic Kingdom with the sort of sociality and sense of purpose that form the backbone of the current rush of university courses meant to improve the lives of students now and help them to develop the skills and sense of direction that will offer them the best hope of a good life after graduation. I don't know much about happy hours. My sense for a significant sociality in happy hours comes mostly from watching television shows about imaginary people involved in law enforcement. TV cops and lawyers use happy hours to make progress both in life and in work. I mean, sometimes they get in fights, but, you know. I have no idea what happens off screen, but what matters for my purposes is that episodes of pleasure in food, drink, and company, which are not usually the stuff of serious philosophical questions about happiness, are nevertheless important. And I mean, for philosophers, pleasure in eating an ice cream cone is sometimes taken to be exactly the kind of happiness that doesn't matter at all. Even if it's like really good ice cream with your friends. Now, mind you, there have been a couple of important philosophers who wanted it to be the case that the kind of deep and lasting happiness that they took to be crucial to the highest good in human life carried adults towards something of the wonder and delight of a child's introduction to the pleasures of Disneyland. Aristotle, although admitting that a virtuous life might be pretty miserable, like he knew this, right, fudged things a little by insisting that it was nevertheless enjoyable, that is, filled with pleasures, like the pleasure of virtuous activity, which you can get even if you're about to die on the battlefield, I guess. Contemplation, the life of contemplation had different restrictions for Aristotle, but again, you know, he sort of acted like it was full of pleasures. I take it that the need to find some place for what we would normally understand as pleasure in an account of the kind of happiness that ought to matter for philosophers and for everyone else, actually, points to the need to tie an account of happiness to something that people will recognize as at once happy and worth caring about. I'm going to talk about two serious thinkers who took it that some sort of happiness belonged to the highest good to which we can aspire, and that the relevant kind of happiness was the sort of thing that a normal person might see as pleasant or enjoyable, as something not just desirable in some sort of lofty philosophical sense of that term, but genuinely desired by people. And we've caught this thread all along today. And I'm going to the two philosophers I'm going to focus on are my favorite Teutonic monument, Immanuel Kant, right, And also our old friend Aquinas. Okay. Both take it that we need something of God in an account of the happiness worth pursuing. But I'm going to start approaching these guys by having a look at a sort of puzzle that arises in connection with philosophical work on the highest good, and approach Kant and then Aquinas through thought about how they address this puzzle. Throughout, I'm going to operate on the assumption that philosophers are right to think that a proper understanding of the happiness worth seeking is tied to a proper understanding of the highest good we can seek. Now, very few contemporary philosophers outside sort of specific religious traditions are especially concerned with whether or not there is or could be a summum bonum, a highest good. Of course, philosophers used to take it that developing an account of the highest good was crucial to work in ethics, social philosophy, and political philosophy. That we need to understand the highest good was a commonplace in ancient Greek philosophy, for example, and interest in what might count as the highest good survived into like 18th and 19th century European philosophy. Now, why isn't it enough to understand that people will try to seek such good as they can recognize without taking the extra step of supposing that we need to see ourselves as participating in communities striving to realize a highest good? What does a sense for the highest good add to our efforts to understand our genuine attraction to good, willingness to will the good in others, and self-understanding as unique individuals drawn toward participation in communities devoted to realizing good in the lives of all their members? Well, I mean, I guess I'll give some standard responses. And for one thing, having a sense for the highest good allows us to set our priorities better. If those of us who think of ourselves primarily as teachers, which I kind of do, if teachers know, for example, that we most want all of our students to flourish, to sort of realize their potential, to develop their particular talents and capacities, and to support the flourishing of their fellow students, we know that the lessons of classroom environments that we produce need to be geared to the needs and grounded aspirations of our students. We can use our concern over providing educational resources that promote flourishing to think differently about all aspects of our lives with our students, and to provide opportunities for students to contribute to the well-being of their fellows. Rather than just working to strengthen their individual skills in math, for example, we might design exercises that give more advanced students opportunities to help students who are struggling, setting up an expectation in the classroom that we thrive best when we thrive together, that kind of thing. Then, too, having an overarching sense for the highest good explains why we may be willing to sacrifice some measure of private advantage for the sake of the higher good. I take it that all of us have had the experience of leaving aside at least some small opportunities for personal gain for the sake of something that we take to be more important. But if all having a sense of higher goods does is allow us to set our priorities in general and make trade-offs when necessary, then it isn't clear why we should need any sense that there is a single highest good. After all, setting priorities and making sensible trade-offs sounds a lot like solving scheduling problems. It isn't clear why we should need to wheel machinery as big as a claim about the highest good onto the stage in order to handle scheduling problems. So why go in for thought about the highest good at all? I used to ask this question a lot myself, like, okay, I mean, I think there probably is one, but why do you need it? Why do you need anything that big? And my view has changed. I'm going to urge that we need thought about the highest good to make sense of our efforts not just to design individually satisfying lives, which I think we can do without that, but to understand our lives together as aimed at a shared pursuit of common good. And the kinds of common goods we pursue, we need something higher than just aggregate individual good sense. Now, as far as I know, most European thought about the highest good involves a really interesting philosophical puzzle. The puzzle goes like this. Given that most prominent thinkers who have developed accounts of the nature and character of the highest good have argued that we cannot experience unimpeded enjoyment of the highest good in this life, in what sense can the highest good provide a target for us, collectively? And possibly even worse, most of these thinkers seem to hold that even if I am absolutely determined to orient my life to the highest good, I'm never going to be able to attain it by my own efforts. In what sense can I sensibly so much as seek the highest good, much less have confidence that I've set my sights on an appropriate object, if I can't know what it will be like in advance? And the one thing I can know is that I'm never going to attain it under my own steam. We are, the relevant thinkers have tended to argue, bound to seek a thing that is neither part of individual experience nor even of collective human experience more generally. How are we supposed to aim at something like that? Now, Immanuel Kant, Teutonic Monument and Truths, gives interesting answer to this question. Kant argues that the kind of happiness that we all seek is happiness in proportion to virtue. That is, what we're really after in seeking our own happiness is that we be only as happy as we are good. Understanding the concept of the highest good in Kant is sort of complicated. Kant insists that happiness is an aspect of the highest good, where the desires or inclinations associated with happiness belong to what Kant calls self-love. But he argues that what we want is not plain happiness of the ordinary variety, but is instead happiness in proportion to virtue. Virtuous dispositions carry the universality at issue in Kant's understanding of morality. Now, it's not obvious how the two aspects of the highest good can be brought into relation, much less welded together as a totality that is the supreme object of the will of a finite, sensuous, rational being. I'm going to rely on Stephen Engstrom's sort of magisterial interpretation to bring Kant into this exploration of thought about happiness and the highest good. According to Kant, finite, sensuous beings are necessarily interested in their own happiness. This is like the drive that we heard discussed first off. Where happiness is understood in terms of satisfaction of desires, inclinations, and needs. This is the kind of happiness at issue in the Disneyland slogan, in happy meals and in happy hour. Insofar as this happiness counts as the practical face of self-love, desires, inclinations, and needs are among those features of agency that serve to distinguish one sensuous rational being from every other such being. It's what makes it about myself rather than just about rational nature generally. They are subjective and contingent. That is, in Kant, in Anglophone Kant speak, these are conditional. Okay. Now, as many of us know, maybe all of us know, Kant takes it that morality, on the other hand, is objective, that is, universal and unconditional. Whatever else one wants to say about happiness in proportion to virtue, then, one must at least say that this end will require that virtue or morality operate in such a way as to constrain pursuit of happiness. How's that supposed to happen? Well, Engstrom puts it this way, quote, Kant characterizes self-love as an ineradicable propensity of finite rational nature to claim personal happiness to be something good, an end for others as well as for oneself. Self-love is a natural propensity to pursue one's own happiness and, in pursuing it, to claim it to be good. Close quote. In self-love's implicit claim that satisfying its desires, inclinations, and needs, it is seeking good, self-love offers itself up as reasonable. Claiming a thing to be good is, for Kant, necessarily claiming it to be a thing reasonably desired, rationally pursued, a candidate, at least, for universal objective regard. Virtue, as Kant understands it, is the subtle disposition, the strength, to overcome such inclinations as might be contrary to morality. Now, as Kant knows perfectly well, virtue, the disposition to constrain one's pursuits by the demands of morality, comes in degrees. The proportionality aspect of the highest good recognizes this point. It asks that everyone be only as happy as they are good, and that every virtuous person enjoy such happiness as is compatible with good character. This, then, is the nature of the highest good by Kant's lens. Notice that the highest good is a sort of a totality. It is not in my power to realize this totality, even if my rational benevolence functions beautifully in my efforts to secure both my happiness and the happiness of everyone around me to the extent that any of us merits happiness. As Kant argues, it's not even in the power of any arbitrarily large society of finite rational beings to attain the highest good. After all, nature need neither reward virtue nor bring ruin to the lives of the vicious. Nothing about the workings of nature makes it impossible that a whole society of the mostly virtuous will not be brought low by some catastrophe, like the Lisbon earthquake that so shook Kant's thinkers in Kant's day. In this sense, none of us knows what it would be like to inhabit a natural world where the best of us was spared the many kinds of unhappiness associated with infirmity, injury, loss, and the like. And none of us can make the world such that what will happen always and everywhere coincides with what's supposed to happen. Practical reason, according to Kant, tracks the laws governing what's supposed to happen. These are not the same as empirical laws governing what will happen. It is at this point that Kant introduces two of his three practical postulates, that God exists and that the soul is immortal. As is true for understanding Kant's account of the highest good, understanding Kant's claims about the practical postulates has been a point of considerable scholarly controversy. I'm going to give a fairly simple reading of the postulates and their status. My aim is simply to show how Kant works to respond to the question how we're to see ourselves as oriented to the highest good, even though we can have no direct experience of its attainment. It is, I think, strictly for Kant, impossible that a finite, sensuous, rational being could have any experience of the highest good in mortal life. Kant's moral agent is finite and dependent. By definition, such agents are not in a position to bend the cosmos to their wills, to enact universal laws, to set laws of nature, and so on. To that extent, it cannot be in the power of the kinds of beings we are to attain the highest good under our own steam, individually or collectively, because we can't keep nature from disrupting the happiness of really good people or allowing really bad people to flourish in some ordinary sense of that term. That is, for Kant, attainment of the highest good possible for finite, sensuous, rational beings is out of reach in principle. It's not just like we can't quite figure out how to do it. It's like, given the kinds of creatures we are and the kind of world, natural world we inhabit, we cannot attain the highest good. we can't guarantee that happiness and virtue are going to coincide in the right sort of way. Is that clear? It's kind of amazing and beautiful. Kant's response to, so in what sense is it orienting our activity at all, the highest good and Kant? Kant's response to the question, if I understand him, rests in the work of the, on the practical postulates. There are three practical postulates. The first is that I am free. The second is that God exists. And the third is that the soul is immortal. Now, most contemporary Anglophone scholars of Kant really love that freedom postulate and do their best to just ignore the other two. I confess that I have yet to encounter an interpretation of the immortality postulate that makes any sense. And there is so much philosophical work on the freedom one that I can't think what I would add to it. I think it's kind of wild how much work there is on that one. What's going to concern me instead is the postulate about God. A practical postulate for Kant is a framing assumption necessary to making the fundamental operations of practical reason, as he understands these, intelligible. If it makes sense to understand finite, sensuous, rational beings as addressees of imperatives, that is, as beings that can know the better and choose the worse, then such beings must be operating under the implicit assumption that they have the power to choose to do as they ought to do, or choose otherwise. To that extent, the whole account of finite, sensuous, rational beings as addressees of imperatives relies upon the assumption that such beings are free, a thing that Kant assures us cannot be proved. Their freedom is no part of their experience of themselves. It's rather a background condition on the efficacy of practical reason. And that practical reasoning can be efficacious is presupposed in any exercise of practical reason. I can deliberate about what to do. I can't deliberate about whether to do it under my own steam. Like, if I'm deliberating, I'm deliberating about it. How would I do? Even if what I want is to get somebody else to do something instead. How does God get into this picture? Now, Kant thinks he's established that a totality consisting in happiness in proportion to virtue is the supreme object of practical reason, what each of us strives to realize, even though none of us can produce a world in which happiness is in fact proportioned to virtue. Since my practical reasoning in any instance is constrained by what it's in my power to accomplish, by Kant's light, the thing that my own reason demands as its ultimate end lies entirely beyond my power. We can't make sense of my practical judgment and my efforts to cultivate virtue without seeing these aspects of my life as aimed at my participation in the highest good. I can't direct myself to any good that's entirely unrealizable. To the extent that I operate to allow morality to constrain my pursuit of happiness, I implicitly treat happiness in proportion to virtue as realizable. It's what I seem to be going for. God's agency is the agency that could realize the highest good, a thing that is in principle out of reach for the very creatures necessarily directed to its realization. The practical postulate that God exists secures the possibility of the highest good. Now, Kant's God is in many respects, I am going to talk about somebody's God here, is in many respects peculiar. Kant's is a strangely thin God, knowable only in the sense that its existence secures the intelligibility of various aspects of practical philosophy. It's not just that Kant aspires to a religion within the limits of reason as Kant understands these. It's that Kant is content with a God that operates as a necessary but strictly incomprehensible guarantor of the intelligibility of the highest good. This is a god spun from philosophy, a god that is at best at some remove from the operation of practical reason from one day to the next. Even if this god created finite, sensuous, rational beings, it is not a god that directly legislates the moral law by which these beings steer their lives, which constrains their pursuit of happiness, and which sets the terms for the best that any and all of them can hope to see. It's not obvious whether or how one would worship this god. It's not clear in what sense one might associate this god with love. This god is, in theory, a source of providence. It's not clear in what ways this god might be in actuality providential, or whether and how it might concern itself with the very beings who unknowingly rely on it in cultivating the strength needed to hold fast to morality in action. Now, like many thinkers before him, and at least one thinker after, Kant ties the form of happiness crucial to the best we can see to the development of a good character. I take it that what he's reaching for, in reaching for happiness as crucial to the highest good, is a picture of happiness that takes seriously the thought that we're living in community with one another, and that the happiness worth striving for is the happiness that brings each of us along with one another. Kant works to get that happiness by trying to isolate what he urges are the demands of reason. I take it that one of his insights, and an insight that's shared across otherwise pretty diverse philosophical accounts of the highest good, is that the happiness that can serve as a highest good for us is happiness as a common good, rather than happiness as aggregate individual satisfaction. My growing suspicion is that we do need to suppose a highest good in practical philosophy, and that this has to be a common good if it's to fill the roles that we need filled by a sense of the highest good. We may not need it to make sense of setting priorities individually or in variously large groups of individuals, but I suspect that we need it to understand shared efforts to promote, for example, social justice or cultural change. And it's at this point that I'm going to return to Aquinas, not on cultural change, but on God, actually. Now, for Aquinas, of course, the highest good is God, and my best hope is that by grace I will be with God, as Adam was talking about. Given this characterization of what I seek in seeking the highest good as Aquinas understands it, the philosophical questions, I think, are stunningly more difficult to answer than when we're thinking with Aquinas than they are when we're thinking with Kant. After raising the questions in connection with Aquinas' work, I'm going to draw from some aspects of one way of reading his Christology and finding a sort of an answer. I realize I am in over my head at this point, right? There are theologians in the front row speaking of what should make you nervous. It's making me nervous. Okay. Now, I mean, according to Kant, in Willing the Highest Good, I will a thing entirely beyond my power to bring about, to so much as operate as if the highest good is attainable. And that picture of the highest good is flowing directly from abstract reflection on the pure practical reason operative in finite, sensuous, rational beings. The moral agent implicitly assumes such God as is needed to be the agent that might actualize the highest good. The highest good necessarily orients my reach and eludes my grasp on Kant's account, but the seeds of my orientation to the highest good are bound up with practical reason as such on his view. So I don't need to comprehend the God of the practical postulate in order to be directed to the good that this postulated God is introduced to make possible. By Aquinas' lights, I need a source outside my own reason if I am to seek in humility, reverence, obedience, and wonder the sort of final end that promises to satisfy the whole restless longing of my heart by granting me a vision of God. Now, I mean, what kind of confidence can you have that such a thing is possible for me? Is there any sort of basis for my hope here? I mean, this is way past it's somehow seated in practical reason itself, which is in me, the Kant world. Okay. Now, I'm going to follow a theologian called Simon Gain in urging that Aquinas' account of Christ's immediate knowledge of God holds out the possibility of perfect supernatural beatitude to believers. Aquinas' understanding of the incarnation gives the basis for a theological response to the question about the sense in which I can orient myself to a final end that I cannot fully comprehend. And this is really difficult. I mean, it's not just that I'm supposed to be able to pray and have some sense of God being immediately with me. That is certainly there. It's supposed to be that if I'm enjoying the beatific vision, I'm participating in God's knowledge of God, right? It's like, in a resurrected state. I mean, it's really, really hard to get your head around that. At least I find it hard. If it's easy for any of you, ask a question about that of yourself. Sorry. I'm going to follow Guy Mancini in tracing Aquinas' account of the earthly Christ's knowledge of God. Mancini, like Simon Gain, is indebted to Bernard Largan for his work on the question of how the earthly Christ communicated something of divine knowledge to human beings. But I take it that Lonergan goes a step beyond Aquinas in his exploration of this question. I'm just going to side with St. Thomas. There have been a number of attempts to urge that Aquinas provides a metaphysical explanation for faith in the teachings of Christ. As Mancini argues, this doesn't seem to be the tack that Aquinas takes. Rather, Aquinas proceeds by understanding what the incarnation is supposed to accomplish and by tracing what has to be true of the incarnate Word if the Word made flesh is to accomplish the teaching and salvific task that could not be accomplished unless God came among us as a human being. In effect, in order for the human Christ to know his identity and his mission, and to teach us in the way that was necessary if we were to have any hope of salvation and of one day sharing in God's knowledge of God, the human Christ had to have immediate knowledge of God. As Gain put it, the Savior needed to see the Father. And of course, in seeing the Father, needed to have divine understanding of the Trinity and that the three persons are consubstantial. This was crucial if Christ was knowingly to be who he was and do what he did. Interweaving commentary on the structure of Aquinas' discussions of the incarnate Word in the Summa Theologiae with Aquinas' commentaries on Scripture, Mancini summarizes Aquinas' teaching this way, quote, "What we know in faith, we know because of the preaching of Christ. From that content, we may conclude to what he knows as man in his human soul. But since that content either asserts or implies the identity of Christ as the Word of the Father, we conclude at last both to his identity and to his divine knowledge of Christ as God. In this order of things, the theorem of the man Christ's immediate knowledge of God becomes evident as what it is, an account, or part of the account, of the datum of faith, precisely as the datum is handed to our faith from the human preaching of the human Christ. Thus, St. Thomas knows Christ's beatific knowledge because it is required to explain the fact recorded in the Gospels and grasp the faith of what our Lord knows and tells us. St. Thomas knows the beatific knowledge of Christ as the theological glue of an argument conventio, and in the absence of a metaphysical education, that serves as a bridge in the disciplinary order between a consideration of the soul of Christ and a consideration of the properties of that soul. End quote. What we know by faith, the teaching of Scripture, Jesus knew directly and immediately. And so, among other things, in Christ we have an example of a human being who knows God in the way that God knows God. That it was necessary that such knowledge be communicated, however imperfectly, by a human being among human beings, can be seen as one of the reasons that the humanity of Christ was crucial to his mission. And it is because of the Incarnation that we can have a sense of what might be possible for us in attaining our final end. Mancini puts the point this way, quote, "Knowing God in God's way, the end state of our knowledge as Christians, a state St. Thomas imputes to Christ in his earthly life, is what is called the beatific vision. By this is meant an immediate knowledge of God as he is in himself, the finite mind sharing in the infinite act of understanding, the infinite intelligibility that God is. But that such a thing could happen is not known except to faith, and the idea of it is therefore just as much a sort of limit or analogical idea, indeed an anagogical idea, as is the idea we have of God or of the Trinity or of the Incarnation. All St. Thomas really has to say about it is this, that if no created similitude of God could really give us knowledge of him as he knows himself to be, then this knowledge does not happen by way of a created similitude. Or rather, the divine being itself is what is immediately present to the created mind." Quote. Now, I do not know what it will be like to know God in God's way, but the salvific promise is that grace has opened this possibility to each of us through Christ's sacrifice. The possibility is a possibility of a kind of happiness that will actually be genuinely enjoyable. Like, this is not some kind of lofty philosophical happiness that you have to be a specialist to experience for us. That there's going to be real pleasure in a resurrected life, a real sense of perfect fulfillment, and a kind of joy that can actually answer to our longing. And the preceding speakers have addressed this much more eloquently than I have. Kant took on the traditional thought that in directing my efforts to a final end, to a highest good, I aim at something of which I have no experience. He introduced a kind of datum of rational faith to help us understand the possibility of a totality that is our ultimate aim. I thought with Kant in order to explore some of the possibilities of a strictly philosophical attempt to understand the highest good. What we get from even the small foray into Aquinas' thought about the highest good, the theological account, is, I think, clearer. The highest good is God. God is at once creator and legislator, and an economic account of how we come from God and are by grace headed back to God through the salvific identity and mission of Christ provides a structured account of our lot, the darkness in which we often find ourselves, and the kind of light we can hope to enjoy because of Christ. I've offered an inept sketch of what Aquinas gives us, but I hope that it's enough of a sketch to provide a sense of the depth and power of the account.
Hi, thank you for the talk. My question to you is, well, I don't really know much about Kant, but how come he even developed his philosophy of God, like, and made it in such a way?
Kant noticed something really important about reason, about the difference between what he called speculative or theoretical reason, which is the kind of thing that was associated with modern science in his day, and what he called practical reason, which is the kind of reason that we're engaged in figuring out what we're going to do, or in just doing it sometimes in an orderly way. What he noticed was that he was coming on the heels of a Scottish philosopher called David Hume. And David Hume had argued that there was really no basis for induction, that there was no sound logical basis guaranteeing that we could draw from past experience to give a true account of what was going to happen next. And this is actually a really good argument in Hume, and it's a really good argument based on a sort of metaphysical picture. On the metaphysical picture, it goes kind of like this. If what you're talking about is physical events, just plain old physical or chemical events or something, what you're talking about a world is where you just got one thing after another, after another, after another. Okay? Anything that happens will presumably be just another physical event. So there's such a thing as an unexpected physical event, but there's not such a thing as a physical event that wasn't supposed to happen. So Kant is sharing in this view that he's getting from Hume and from the rise of modern science that where the laws of the physical world are concerned, right, what you've got are laws governing what will happen, which we may know or may not know. There may not even be real laws that you can hold on to in this view. That's a point of controversy. What Kant noticed was that practical reason is based on what's supposed to happen. And that you can have a true law about what's supposed to happen, even if it never actually happens. Read the newspaper. Right? You can see that what actually happens seems to bear very little resemblance to what you might think should happen. Really, a lot of the time. It could be the case that what really should happen almost never happens, and you could still be absolutely right about what should happen. Practical reason is answerable to the laws of what should happen. It tracks those laws, not the plain old laws about what's supposed to happen. So what he's trying to do in his practical philosophy is understand the kind of reason that's addressed to the laws about what should happen. And what should happen in the lives of finite, dependent, rational beings, sensuous beings, is that they should get to enjoy as much satisfaction as is possible for them based on how good they are, right? So it shouldn't be the case that terrible people succeed and laugh and feel like they've got everything they want in the world, whereas really great people are ground down by the world, day in and day out. That shouldn't happen. But it's like, that's a pretty common sense, right? He thinks that's all part of common sense morality, that certain people don't deserve to be super happy. Other people you really wish could be super happy look like they're pretty miserable, often because they're engaged in trying to do good work in horrible places. Right, and which is pretty miserable stuff. Like if you're not somehow touched by the people who are dying of the Ebola epidemic when you're there trying to help, that would be really strange. Like we would think it spoke well of you if you were like, yay, you know, as you're doing that work. So the thing that most should happen is that people should get to be as happy as they are good. That's what most should happen, he thinks. And he thinks he's got pretty good and not very sort of super lofty philosophical understanding about how nature is not going to make that occur. So you're going to need something supernatural to make that occur. That's how this God gets spun out of his sense of what... Now, how this attaches to the demands of practical rationality is that my own sense, the kind of thing that Father Dominic was talking about not wanting to be rewarded for something I don't deserve or didn't do, or of enjoying, you know, those things, that's the place where this idea of the highest good is coming from. And that, he thinks, is just built into the operation of practical reason.
How come he didn't accept Aquinas?
Oh, he didn't accept the metaphysics.
Okay.
I mean, modern...
Sorry.
No. I mean, it's like... there's a huge rift between something like Aristotle and Aquinas is pretty deeply Aristotelian, although the Augustinian line has to be there too, but the Neoplatonic stuff is also necessary. But there's a sense in which to get at Aristotle's metaphysics, the easiest thing is to ask what sort of understanding of causality you needed in order to have a handle on the movement and change in living things. And the metaphysics, Aristotle's metaphysics, is sort of finds its happiest home in talking about living things. So biology still can't do without some Aristotelianism, actually. If you want to understand what's going on at the dawn of modern philosophy and modern science and all that stuff, you can picture Newton wondering, how do we explain, what kind of causality do we need to explain the motion of a kind of thing that obeys Kepler's laws? Really different question. Really different question. But Newtonian physics is sort of based on that. And that's the kind of understanding that informs, that Kant feels like we're going to have to somehow find our way around if we're going to understand practical reason, morality, good, bad, and even, he thinks, biology, you're going to have to get around it.
We have time for one more question.
Thank you for your talk. This was enlightening. What would you say if Aquinas could speak to Kant, what would you think Aquinas would say to Kant to try to remedy his philosophy or his view of a Christian God?
I think Aquinas would start by saying that Kant misunderstands reason. I think it's that deep, the difference between them. That Kant is thinking that there's something called reason, which is going to be what it is wherever it shows up. And so if it turned out that dolphins are finite dependent rational beings, some readings of Alistair McIntyre might suggest he flirts with, then the reason in the dolphin is exactly the same as the reason in me and my mother and the Martians. So he's treating his preferred object of inquiry, the finite dependent rational being, as almost like the name of an Aristotelian species. And I think that Aquinas would say that can't be the name of a species of being. So you can read Kant as doing this attempt to explore the way Aristotelian would explore the nature of a kind of being. It's just that he doesn't have his sights actually set on a kind of being. Is that not?
Great, well, please join me in thanking Professor Vogler.